Welcome back to the SCBWI podcast. Forgive the gaps, but we do have a ton of amazing shows all lined up for you. I'm your host, Theo Baker, and on today's episode, I talk to the incredible illustrator and fine artist, Katia Chen. If you don't know her work, Katia is a Brazilian-Taiwanese illustrator, and since 2008, she's illustrated a number of just spellbinding picture books, like her Golden Kite winner, A Boy and His Jaguar, and the beloved, The Bear and the Moon. Her work is unique, surreal, and deeply sensitive, and travels along strange inner avenues of color, texture, and form to find unexpected meaning. You might tear up reading one of her books without quite understanding what's going on or what's moving you. I talked in person with Katia at the Winter Conference in New York, where people were raving about her creative lab. And from where she'd just come, and running only on fruit and fumes, I had a wonderful conversation with her about connecting with inner filaments, that will make sense in a minute, and with her capacity to feel, experimentation, distortion, form, and finding your way to the heart of things. I hope you enjoy. I'm here with Katia. Thank you so much for coming.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So if you could tell me about where you come from, and you can answer that however you want. There's no limits on that.
Where I come from, well, where physically I come from is I was born and raised in Brazil. And, you know, I come from Taiwanese parents. And I come from a line of really strong women. My mom has 8 sisters and 1 brother, and she's the oldest sister. And all the aunts are very opinionated. So I was surrounded by women that gathered around each other with a lot of tips and advice, problem solving, you know. So I think in a way, like, I was raised with a lot of emotional resiliency and openness and honesty, and a sense of community was really pretty much there from the very beginning. Like, I basically lived in a community with them in Brazil. A few of my aunts also moved to Brazil when we were there. And I also lived in this really awesome, like, apartment complex. They call it the Covariqui. Yakumasu, which is a neighborhood in Brazil. And it was this complex of 5 or 6, I forget, it was like maybe 7 different apartment complexes, all surrounded a park. And then my aunts were, you know, they were nearby. And so my cousins, and I always had playmates, like I always had cousins or people within that condominium to play with. And we kind of led a very, I would say, like, childhood was so magical because we had separate lives and adults. And that is something that I think you don't get too much of these days. And I just really feel like it really informed, I think, my sense of imagination and possibility that I could cultivate that life so early on. And I didn't have to report to my mom in that way. Although she was, you know, a tiger mom in some ways, but she just, for some reason, it just, where we were, allowed for that. And I really, so that's where I'm from.
Thank you for that. Did you get a sense of when you were growing up, you said it was magical. Did you know it was magical?
I think it felt risky. Yeah. So I think that for me as a kid, when I say magical, that feels like more of an adult perspective mm-hmm. on what a child is going through, because I feel like as a sensitive kid, all I knew was that I had permission to do things that probably my parents wouldn't want me to do if they saw it. Mm-hmm. Oh, they knew that we were doing that. I mean, we were going to, you know, we were playing with Ouija boards and, like, doing, like, I don't know, these things that I guess universally are known, like, because even kids here know about that kind of stuff. But in Brazil, like, I think, you know, just taking risks, like, they were going to cemeteries, like, some of the darker stuff, like, but then we were also, so I think magic, yeah, it's a, more of an adult perspective on it. I think as a kid, it was just more the sense of freedom, the sense of being able to explore where my attention and curiosity led me. And then this feeling of being held in this safety of whatever the neighborhood was. And somehow I felt safe. I mean, I remember the story, which is so wild, honestly. I don't even know. I know I didn't make it up because I checked it with my sister. She's 2 years older than me, and supposedly she remembers more than I do. Yeah. Okay, I don't know if I agree with that, because she will correct me on a lot of things, but I remember how this one instance where this one neighbor, and I didn't know him directly. We didn't know him directly. This older man who lived in one of the complexes, and this Japanese man, and he was taking a walk, you know, like I don't think I've ever seen him until that day. And he was just walking with his dog. And then he started to talk to us, and like, it's unheard of to have an adult that you're not related to be talking to kids and that being okay. So he was talking to us, you know, maybe he's like 60s or something. Mm-hmm. And then he said to us like, oh, you know, I want to show you guys something that I collect. I collect these flowers that are made of light. And I remember thinking, what are you talking about? This is crazy. And as a kid, and I think I was like 8 and she was 10. And of course we went, right? We went with him to his apartment. And he made cocoa for us. And then he showed us these beautiful, I don't know if you've ever seen these like optical light fibers that you can like, light fibers that light up into like different shapes. And they're all these flower arrangements made of these fiber lights. I don't even know if I'm describing it correctly. It sounds crazy. But he had these around his apartment. He collected these things. And he was so wild.
And so you just go into this apartment and there are these things that you can't really conceive of, like made out of light and flowers. And you're like, okay, I took this risk and went with this odd guy.
Yeah.
Who probably shouldn't be talking. I'm reminded of like, what's the guy who wrote Fahrenheit 451? Oh, I'll think of it later. I always get
Is it Raymond Carver?
Almost Raymond Carver.
No, it's not. Okay.
Whatever. Okay. Raymond Carver is that, he's that short story guy. We're both thinking of the same
Yes, place. We are.
But he talks about when he was about that age, like the traveling circus came to town. And he met with somebody named Mr. Electricity.
Oh my God.
And like ran away. You know, so like, I love that kind of, what you're talking about, risky. Risky is such a cool word because kids are close to the ground of, you know, death. Like, things feel risky. They're closer to the floor of, you know, they climb things. I almost fell today. And in your books, that's always there. There's this kind of something in the corner, you know, a kind of presence. Like, did you feel that kind of, I'm just curious about that. Like, I know how I would define it, which is like, I remember being close to, like, almost like every day, like, I get this fear, like, oh, I almost died just now, you know? And what was scaring you as a kid? What was the risk that like you were afraid of?
The only risk that I was afraid of that I remember, which is again, the naivete of a child, is my mom. Mm-hmm. I think she was the only person that I was really fearful of. And that's why I think it's so interesting when I think about the magic, right? Because I feel like children kind of don't have the perception of their vulnerability in some ways. Like they have physical vulnerabilities and they certainly understand when they trip and they fall and it sucks and they're so sad about that. But in terms of all the political and all the other dangers that are in place, like they're not holding on to that. And so they take more risks in connecting with other humans. That I think it was nice to be in that bubble for a little bit. And that's in a way, like, I definitely am grateful for my parents for being able to even have that, give me that. And then I think, also, I feel like risk, my mom, but also I think my relationship with risk as a kid was more about, and I wonder if I'm just, because I'm also thinking of reminding me of my son. And so I'm trying to think about in that place of when I was a kid, like really, what was actually risk? What was it that motivated me to do something, right? Like it honestly, I feel like it starts early, that sense of pushing up against the world to understand it. So you're not trying to break the rules. You literally are trying to figure out where the rules are and why are they there? And do they make sense to you in a tangible way? And what are these things that function inside of yourself that is a gut feeling? What is that? Like, ultimately, you can't practice gut feeling unless you take risks until you go out there and you push up against the thing inside of you that says no or yes. But if you're, like, isolated, you can't really practice that. So I think that's part of it.
Yeah, do you think there's a a continuous line or thread or light fiber from that kind of intuitive, because what your art is so intuitive, and I know that it's not, when I hate that word, because intuitive means, oh, I don't have to think about it. I don't have to practice. It just comes easy. Of course not. But you are always exploring kind of how far can I push it? How far can I get away with distorting a figure until it's almost not a figure anymore? You can still recognize it as a figure. Do you see that kind of inner sensibility? Because we're all trying to recapture that spontaneity of childhood when there were no rules. Or there are only the rules of don't die, come home, you know? And the rules was have fun, make it feel good, make it feel something. Do you think that there's a line from that childhood to your art making now?
Yeah, I really do. I think in the best of days, I can channel that. And I think it's so interesting because I think about what that intuitive place is and why, what it is. Because as you were asking me the question, what came up for me was this feeling that, what am I trying to recreate here? What is this thing that is calling me back to something that I already, that I know? Like, you're kind of making the link, right, to childhood. And I was thinking about how it's that place where you don't have to explain, right? Because when something is completely defined, you're going to have to explain to somebody why you made those decisions, because they're so direct. And kind of the harshness of the light on it feels like they're welcoming those kind of criticisms, where there's something about, you know, creating that space in which you can just be, you know, that is so rare these days, to kind of have that space, especially within something that's in the visual arts that is asking for you to engage with it and have opinions on it. There's something really, for me, that's really safe to create kind of my own interpretation of something that's a little bit fluid, a little bit like hiding, a little bit like, because in a way, like, I think everyone obsesses about invisibility cloaks, and I'm sure children do too. There's this, why is that? Like, do you want to not exist? Probably not. It's just that you want to experience the world in your own terms without having to have, you know, I guess, opinions and change, you know, manipulations on that. And I think perhaps it's a little bit about that. There's a little bit of that calling me to that, to my childhood bit, you know, I think. And yeah, thanks for linking that, because it just kind of came up when you were talking.
Yeah, the invisibility cloak, because that's every kid. It's like the two superpowers is invisibility or flying.
Yeah.
And invisibility is a weird one, because especially with art, you're embodying things. You know, your body. I remember reading, like, in some sort of seminar, like, seeing is such a crazy thing, because when we see a little bit of our nose. I see a little bit of my glasses.
Oh my gosh.
You know, I see a little of my hand, and like, we're embodied. But like, and then there's this thing where then you kind of erase, your brain sort of erases that.
Yeah.
And you're like this floating head, this floating eyeball. So how do you, when you're walking around in the world and you're trying to kind of see the world, tell me about like how you see, and like how, especially when you're starting to make art, like how your eye, because it's not normal seeing. Tell me about like how you're starting to see, especially your own work.
I think what's happening is, and I love that you're talking about these ways in which we then normalize certain things that are in our periphery, because that's sort of part of, you know, as an artist, like, you're constantly editing what you pay attention to, what you don't pay attention to, and what you obsess over and what you don't. And so in a way, like, when you're talking about seeing and how then you edit out the fact that you're always looking at your nose or like seeing parts of your nose, I think for me, the practice of seeing as an artist has been more about the practice of feeling and then channeling what it is that I'm able to then have a relationship with, because I'm feeling things deeper. And there was a time when I was numbed out, like completely numbed out. And I had a lot of, you know, guards up, a lot of armor, a lot of trying to perfect things and trying to kind of, almost keep things out so that I can perfect something one thing at a time. And then when that got removed, when I worked through that, again, it's like an internal thing, then the seeing changed, because then I could have a relationship with stuff in a different way, and relationship with myself and how I felt about it. Yeah, so it all came from that.
Right, and it comes in and changes you, and you reflect it. We'll get more specific and talk about the books in a minute, but like what you're talking about, that numb feeling, I know a lot of artists go through that at one phase or another. Either they've made a couple books and like they feel like, oh, you know, I put it out there. But like everyone kind of fights through that there's this numbness that happens often. I just came through the other side of it like a year or two ago. Mm. And it's a strange thing where you just don't care and you're like, I'm just going to be in my shell.
Yeah.
And I'm going to just be in my head. Tell me about, like, if you don't mind.
Yeah,
like,
I don't mind.
If you don't mind going there.
Yeah.
Tell me about how you worked through that.
That was when I was going through art school.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was really hard because I, you know, for all the reasons, going to a really extremely demanding art school, and you're there because you really want to be, you're feeling really grateful. My grandfather was helping me through it too, so he felt, you know, there was a lot of responsibilities with doing really well, and everyone was so technically proficient, could draw everything, and I could see all of my shortcomings. So there's a lot of comparing, a lot of working through the nights and not sleeping well, not taking care of the body well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, in terms of where I was at, that was emotionally, I was only able to do all the things that I actually got through in terms of putting aside the body and the needs that I had of like keeping myself hydrated on time and all this stuff. It's just ignoring those cues and numbing out. And I think I just was feeling really burned out, to be honest. I was feeling really burned out, but I knew I had to finish and I had to keep going. I had to do well. And there was a moment that all that kind of, I was awake to that, because for a while it's fine. You can actually survive and even thrive in that. And then I remember there was a moment where, so I went to Art Center, College of Design in Pasadena, and you go down this leader street, and then sometimes they have like deer crossings signs and stuff. Sometimes it happens. And I was driving home one day and it was really late night. I think it was a 4 a.m. kind of thing,
yeah.
3 a.m. And then there's a bunch of us had stayed up all night in the campus working on something. So we left at the same time, and we, you know, a row of cars like leaving at the same time, going down that road. And then I was the first in line and I was driving. And then this deer jumped in front of my car and I hit the deer. I hit this deer. And I stopped the car. My friend who was behind me, another car, stopped his car. And I came out of my car and I saw this deer on the side. It was hurt. And then, I mean, it was a scene from Bambi, because then the babies were over nearby. And I just remember looking at the scene and feeling nothing. And I was like, holy crap, what is wrong with me? And I was just staring at this, and we called animal control. We did all the things, but I literally couldn't feel. And I remember my friend came out and he was crying.
Yeah.
And I just remember looking at him and I was just like, what the hell is happening with me?
Yeah.
And then, I drove home that night. And in my dreams, I kept hitting the deer over and over again, as if my subconscious was trying to ask me something. And that was the moment where I started to pay attention to that.
Wow.
And turned it around.
Wow, that's an amazing story. I see that. It doesn't get, reality doesn't hit you more than that, which is, we're all animals, all dying animals. And my God, to extend that sympathy out into the world and to learn to do, because it's painful.
And, it's painful.
You know? Wow, thank you so much for that.
Yeah.
We've been talking with illustrator and fine artist Katya Chen. If you'd like to learn more about her work, I urge you to pick up whatever books of hers you can and visit her website at katyachen.com. We talk specifically about her 2023 book, All the Beating Hearts, written by Julie Fogliano. And be sure to check out another of her 2023 offerings, On the Tip of the Wave, about the artist Ai Weiwei, written by Joanna Ho. Okay, let's get back to part two.
I want to get into your books.
Okay.
We're going to ground it a tiny bit more. But hopefully we can take flight whenever we feel like it.
Okay.
So you've done grad school. And I think your first books were around 2008, or was that?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Sea Serpent and Me.
Sea Serpent and Me. Yeah. That was the first one. Just tell me about were you fascinated with books growing up? You were in art school. Was this a goal that you wanted to make books at some point?
I loved books as an object.
Yeah.
But I was not much of a reader. Mm-hmm. I was more of an outdoor kid, kind of just getting my hands dirty, climbing trees, not really being, maybe I wasn't literate for a long time. Like, I think my mom just wasn't the kind of parent that would read to us at night. And so I didn't have that growing up. But I loved art objects. Like, I know that as I got older, I always was fascinated by aesthetics and beauty. And my dad, actually, I take a lot from my dad for that. He was very different than my mom in that way. She was very practical, and he was sort of the person that loved beauty and art, even though he didn't do that for a living. He kind of did that just as a hobby for himself. So he would actually do paper cutouts and do beautiful images just for himself. Yeah, so I think that for me, it wasn't always a goal to be a picture book illustrator, because I didn't even really have much of a connection to picture books. I had some stories that I liked, but ultimately, I think that I love film. It was I actually love film more as the first thing that I actually loved more than anything else. And I wanted to do concept art and do that.
You wanted to work for the factory in the studio.
I mean, the factory.
Yeah, be one of those kind of movie artists where they're like, all right, we need 800 sketches of this tomorrow. And you design us a futuristic spaceship or do that kind of, that's what you want. More or less. Right?
I actually, yeah. And it was kind of, it's so funny thinking about it in that way, because I'm such a slow artist, it's good luck trying to get that much out of her. But I love the blue sky idea, that somebody would have you work for them and then have you not worry about any speculation of whether or not it can exist. You can just draw whatever that comes to mind, in that portion of the process, because I'm talking about pre-production work. Mm-hmm. So it's actually before you get into production line, where you get to just have a director talk to you about the work and then the story. And then you come up with ideas, you just ideate on random stuff. So that's cool.
And there's no real end product. The end product's going to be this other thing. So this is, I think, a real challenge for someone probably like you, who would, you could, I assume you would just ideate continuously. But each one of your books is uniquely you, but it's also you develop a language for that book. And I often talk a lot of artists about kind of capturing the excitement or the spontaneity of the exploration in the final piece and translating some of that. Tell me about the exploration process, and then the part where you say, okay, I have to stop this and make finished work. Or just tell me about how you go through that. And I'm even interested about how you think about it.
Yeah, I think for me, and I bet some artists can relate, is that when you get to the point where you have to deliver the work that you've ideated on, it can feel a little bit heartbreaking because you're not actually there yet. And so the limitations of time is really what stops it ultimately for me, to be honest with you, because I love that place of exploration so much that sometimes if I get lucky, I might get to something quicker and then be within whatever natural timeline is. But oftentimes I have to stop myself because I just ran out of time.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of the reality, of working on a project. And then in terms of the process of ideating what that looks like, yeah, I mean, I think that I don't really worry too much about keeping, I don't even think about necessarily, being like, oh, I want to make sure that I keep the spontaneity or keep that sort of energy alive. Like I don't, not much of the conscious, controlling is happening. If anything, what I'm actually trying to do is meditate on letting go of some of my assumptions about what can work, because that is me being heavy-handed on something that that could happen on its own in some ways, while keeping certain constraints on, you know, certain like artistic tools that you can use and what the limitations are. But ultimately, like, tapping into a place of not being afraid of taking risks, like big risks, and not having a goal at the end of that. Like, it's a little bit of a mind trick. Like, I have to figure out, I have to like think that I have all the time in the world, even though I know I don't. Like, but that is the place that I need to be.
Right. And I love what you say, letting go of assumptions, because like we can, you know, that can be so deadly, is having those, I assume this will work. I assume people will like it this way. That's the worst one of all. And I was so fascinated by what you said, like in the exploration phase, sometimes you feel like, man, if I only had 6 more months, I'm really getting to something. I'm about to break through to a whole new thing. And no, because I felt that too.
Like, maybe it's just like an illusion that you ever get there.
Well, yeah, that's the thing as well. Like, you might get it 12% better, you know, in 6 months.
Yeah.
And like, but then you wouldn't have a book. It would just be a notebook. You're talking about kind of working within the tools. Do you pick out the tools that you're going to use beforehand and say, okay, these are my tools. Mm. Like, let's just make do with these.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about like how you choose the tools for a project.
I love collecting different art supplies. And so I have a lot of stuff around. So I don't think about it ahead of time where I go, okay, this is going to be a pastel book. That's going to be this or that. Except the only time when I did decide on one, two occasions actually, because of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
I was working out of a basement and I packed up all of our stuff in my family out of the New York apartment we were at, and went to Pennsylvania to work out of a basement at a house. And I could not bring all my paints. And so I had just color pastels and pencils. And so, because it was really portable. So that was the reason for that. Now, where I'm at today, I really have access to all of it. But in a way, it was interesting because then I never worked with pastels then. And now I work with pastels a lot more in my work because of that time. But I will just take whatever medium feels like will, I mean, sounds so, I don't know, it sounds really too much, but it just feels like, yeah, ultimately just try to play with different mediums that I have around and see what the results are and whether that feels right for the tone of the book.
Yeah.
Is where I go with it.
Well, I imagine I love to collect things too. And sometimes like I do that for music. Like I make, collect all these different things. Uh-huh. I've got this big setup. And like, then you want to think, oh, I should use everything in this project, you know? No. Do you set limits? Like, do you set rules for yourself? Like in the course of a project or a book?
Say, yeah.
I can't use the watercolors. I want to, but I can't. Or anything like that?
Yeah, I do. And I think, but I love what you're saying about actually having like, because as a collector of things, like you end up amassing a lot of things that may not go well together. And so I have a lot of really distinct things, like scratch boards, for example, and how does that go with paints, and sometimes like solving that problem is really interesting to me, but there are certain things that don't go well together. But that's all to say that the reason why I even started to do more mixed media work, because before I used pastel and before The Bear and the Moon, I used to do mostly acrylic paintings for my work. And I started to get too stiff. I started to like have assumptions about how to apply it and this and that. And then I needed to have something kind of break that system. Like we talked a little bit about breaking a system, breaking the way you think a little bit so you can grow as an artist, and I was hitting a bit of a wall there. So
maybe it really helps. You got good and competent, and you're like, I know what to do with acrylics.
I got comfortable. I don't know if, you know, I just got comfortable with certain things, like doing certain things in that certain way, and I was like getting a little bit bored with it too. Yeah.
No, they talk about that in music a lot, like the habits of your fingers. Like,
oh, yeah.
I was once asking a teacher, like, how do I want to like expand this. And he said, it's just about like the habits of where your fingers want to naturally go. Like that's how great composers work. they're not having big ideas. They're just developing the range of their habits in their hands.
Cool.
Isn't that cool?
That's really cool.
Yeah, because you always think, like, we project onto, like, the artists we admire, and we think, oh, they're so smart, they're so whatever. And it's just, they've really just developed new, lots of different habits in their fingertips.
Yeah.
I'd love to talk about, since I have it in front of me, I would just love to, this is all the beating parts, beautiful, beautiful. The artwork in this is just, like, stunning, just stunning throughout, and haunting and surreal and kind of subliminal as well. There's layers and ghosts and things look, and the thing that I was so moved by, and I know maybe this is pastels, but it almost felt like crayons and like a child's crayon drawing. And oh my God, this dream. I just opened up to the dream. So you get, I would love to hear, okay, you get this kind of poem. It's not entirely a story. It's more like a feeling. And tell me what you got this, you know, the manuscript from Julie Fogliano. What do you do with it when you get it? And like, tell me about how, what, because mostly you work with other people. You have the magician, I believe. Yes, the magician, the wordless book. But tell me about what you do when you get a manuscript and how you live with it.
Yeah, I love that you said this is not just a poem, it's a feeling, mm-hmm. because that's exactly where I go. When I get a manuscript, I go with the feeling. And then I mapped out the way I feel and I create sort of this overlay of the emotional journey within the story. And that is where I start to kind of figure out tone, even kind of medium I want to use. I will then do some character sketches, some exploratory kind of just color comps. And for this one in particular, the part, I had a bit of a struggle capturing one moment where, you know, in the moment where she is finding her heart, I was trying to figure out what I wanted it to represent. Like, how did I want to represent the heart and the heart beating? Because I wanted it to be more of a feeling. And so much of it is also getting clear on what questions are coming up when I read the manuscript. Mm. Questions about me and questions about feeling. And so some of the questions that came up for me is, where in my life have I felt that way? Mm. And can I look to that, you know, to then translate this? And so it brought me back to the feeling of when I found my heart again. And, you know, we kind of touched in on the numbness. And, mm-hmm. and that was a journey that started. That was, I remember I started to meditate. And I started to take Dharma classes. And I found the work of Thich Nhat Hanh and read books. And I remember I went to this one class. And it was a series of classes about being brave. And after the first class, I remember sitting with these feelings, and then they ask you to sit quietly and then breathe. And then I remember just feeling my heart for the first time in a long time, and then realizing, like, oh, what my heart feels like is a feeling that as a kid, when you first are able to hold a bird, you know, everyone, like, kids are obsessed with birds. They want to, like, you just want to hold the thing. And then you just feel like, you literally feel like you're holding your heart in your hands.
It's like 130 degrees and it's so hot and it's like,
boom, boom, boom. You just feel the beating, boom, 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 right through the little tiny feathers, you know, the skin. And I just remember thinking, oh, I can feel the little beating heart, the little bird inside. And from that story, that's where I got the idea of having her find, you know, when she discovers her heart again, she finds this bird that then takes flight.
Oh.
So
oh my God, that's so amazing. So how that's some serious internal work. So that's not something, can you do that with a pen and paper and art supplies, or like how do you get there internally to find that?
Yeah, that happens all at the same time, because as I'm exploring certain things, right? Because, you know, as artists, like you were talking about how, you know, we kind of learn certain things with our certain habits with our hands. And then we learn to understand the world and process the world through our hands. And so there's more than just a physical manifestation on the page, which is whatever you draw. There's also the processing that happens as you're drawing. And so as I'm drawing, I'm certainly trying to channel a memory, something that then creates a context of what is coming out, so that, you know, it's less about the aesthetics and the color theory and the conceptual idea, and more about whether or not it makes me feel something when I look at it and I recognize it. I recognize it in some way.
I like what you said about representation, because all too often, I know as a writer, there's this thing, what am I trying to accomplish, like with this tableau of words here? Am I trying to recreate? No, not really. Am I trying to describe everything? No. I can't recreate reality. We can represent. Mm. And I like that word represent, because what you're doing as a communicative artist is giving someone a little sign for them to say, oh, I can finish this in my head, and get in touch with the feeling. And you're representing a feeling. And I like what you said about kind of finding it in this evolving process, right? Because you make a mark on the page, and the mark affects you, right? Tell me about how you get to that level, especially for like finished work, because that's such a vulnerable, fragile place.
Yeah.
And if you're saying, this has to be like a finished painting, or my God.
I know, it can be really scary when things start to feel precious, and you kind of start to get paralysis. And you wonder that if you're messing up and the other stuff comes into your head. I think the thing, again, is to kind of trick your mind a little bit. Just as like you breathe whenever you're feeling anxious. Like, I think part of it is just reminding myself that I can do it over.
Yeah, right? You can always do it again, right?
Yeah, you can do it over. And I think, like you said about having like a certain kind of shorthand because you've done it so many times, like that is it is true that even if you have emotionality in your work, you can still hang it on some practical stuff that you have to, you know, where you have to kind of have an idea and then apply it and then be confident in your application. And how to get confident is you do it sometimes more than one time, you know? And so I certainly have painted things over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell me about, like, just in this book, there's also a sequence, because we were talking about filmmaking. There's a very definite sequence of the composition, but also like the colors. The colors are, there's a sequence of the colors, and they're working on me, and I don't know what they're doing, but they're doing something. You probably have a more articulate idea of what they're doing. But tell me about like how you think about sequencing and especially books like this, which are based on a feeling and that are so emotional, and that really the palette shifts throughout this book. There's a lot of books, someone will pick a palette and they're like, this is it. I'm working in these 7 colors. But this palette kind of expands and becomes surprising and shocking, almost like, but in the best way of like a piece of music surprising you, but you know it's coming.
You know?
Tell me about like how you think about sequencing.
Yeah, I think a lot about sequencing. I think that as a picture book, you really do have the opportunity to create an experience, not just a telling of a story, but a whole immersive experience. And color is such a big part of that. And for this book in particular, I knew that it is a book about finding your heart. And then ultimately, it is also a book about experiencing what it feels like when you have something touch your heart. So I wanted to assign that feeling with a color. So magenta is that color. And when you actually pull out if you had all the images like on like a roll, right? And then you kind of looked at it through, like just you shrunk it down to like thumbnail size, you would see that the actual heartbeat of the book is that, like that point when she opens up her heart, because everything is leading up to that magnification of that color. So the book itself has a heartbeat. And all the colors are constrained to that point of, you know, having that big burst of color. So it's definitely designed to be that way. And, you know, whether or not that is appreciated, understood, or whatever. I mean, I think it's just, for me, it's just, I take a lot of pleasure in looking through all the details and coming through all the ways in which I can create all the little alignments, you know, with what the theme is.
Wow. And that's so cool, because you're also thinking, because you're starting with thumbnails, and we read the book as this is what, like 11 by, this is a big book. I'm just curious about like size in the size that you're working at. Cause I know a lot of times artists can work big and then it gets shrunken down to book size. And are you thinking about like the size, if you're working small, and then how does it look blown up? And just tell me a little.
Yeah.
Because you, when it's small in thumbnails, you can wrap your head around it.
Mm-hmm,
right.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not in the same way you can with 32 illustrated images.
Yeah, I keep all my images. I mean, I try to be surrounded by them. So it's like a little bit like the thumbnail kind of process, where I keep all my finals around me as I work on them. And I kind of work a little bit at a time throughout, so that it's cohesive. And I keep all the, everything feels like it's working in 3D, I guess, in a way. Like, and in terms of ratio, like size ratio, like I work 100%. But I'm thinking about working smaller now. I think it's just a matter, because I like the texture. I like magnifying texture on those things. So I think I might try that.
What are you excited to explore like in the future in terms of your art making? What, is there anything that's, you're like, ooh, that feels juicy over there?
Oh, that's such a good question. Thank you for that. I think I want to, I do want to tell my own stories as well. So I think that feels juicy because I don't know how to do that yet. So I think that would be like the unknown that I'm looking to explore, and then keep pushing. I think the opportunity to create with emotions, and hopefully keep making stories and drawings that connect with people.
Katya, thanks so much for coming on our little show today. This was beautiful and inspiring, and the way you talk about your inspiring work is just as impressive. And thank you for kind of your honesty and letting me poke around.
It was amazing. Thank you so much for having me. Honestly, it was a blast.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have today on our program. On behalf of all of us at SCBWI, I'd like to thank Katya for making the time to talk with us. If you've liked what you've heard, please subscribe to our totally free show. Leave us some stars if that's how you feel. And please head over to scbwi.org if you want to learn more about the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. This episode was produced by Chelsea Kimiko Hall and edited by Samantha Thomas. And this podcast is made possible with support from the Authors Coalition of America. Thanks for listening this week, and we'll see you next week, and the week after that, I hope. So long.